Now, I think some people imagine that excommunication is the only form of discipline. But that's not right. In the New Testament, there are various kinds and degrees of discipline. And excommunication is the ultimate discipline when all else has failed. Now, the same was true in the Old Testament. There were different kinds and degrees of discipline. The person who touched the dead body of an animal was unclean till the evening. Leviticus chapter 11. The person who touched the dead body of a man was unclean 7 days. Numbers 19. But the leper was outside the camp until he was cleansed. Leviticus chapter 13. Now the simplest form of discipline is admonition. In Romans 15 and 4, Paul commends the Romans because they were able to admonish one another. In Colossians 3:16, Paul says that the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another. Now there's obviously a difference between teaching and admonishing. Hogg and Vine in their exposition say that teaching means the impartation of positive truths, whereas admonishing has mainly in view things that are wrong and call for warning. 2 Timothy 4 and 2 speaks of reproving and rebuking. Well now, two things are necessary, I believe, if admonishing or reproving is to be effective. First of all, the person admonishing must be loving. Someone has said, if it doesn't hurt you to rebuke another, you're not a fit person to do it. Now, Florence Alshorn was a remarkable woman. She was a missionary in Uganda for years. And then she was in charge of a college for training women missionaries in England. And it was said that she would never rebuke or admonish one of those women without having her arm around her. I mentioned that in our Bible study one Saturday morning, and Margaret Milton said, I would have run when I saw her coming. Perhaps especially if she saw that arm going back. You know that something was coming. Anyhow, quite seriously, we must be loving if we're going to be effective in admonition. But then secondly, the person being admonished must be humble, or at least willing to be made humble, and that may be even more difficult. John Stott, in one of his talks, said that he didn't mind calling himself a miserable sinner in church, but if anybody out of church used language like that to him, he would feel like punching him in the nose. And that doesn't only apply to John Stott. True humility, I believe, is a very rare quality. As Paul Tournier has said, we are all proud, totally proud. That is by nature, and we don't like being admonished. But admonition is very important, and sometimes people go on for years, they have wrong attitudes, they have wrong behavior, and no one has love enough or courage enough to admonish them. Now, I was reading a book by Howard and Jean Henrich some time ago, a book called Footprints, and there's a passage in this book which illustrates what I'm saying. Howard Hendricks wrote this. Prior to graduation from Wheaton College, an administrator called me into his office and read me the Riot Act. Every time I opened my mouth, he told me to keep it shut. I too stormed out of his office, hotter than a hornet, only to reflect that he was really right. My conclusion, I finally met the first person in 22 years who loves me enough to look me in the eye and challenge me with my greatest problem, an undisciplined tongue. In fact, in review, I believe that flaw could have been fatal to my ministry. Another template had been furnished by a spirit-controlled man who truly loved me, and who, like a good surgeon, was willing to hurt in order to heal. Too often I have seen marriages go down the drain, relationships deteriorate to the point of destruction, people with glaring personal limitations go unchecked, all because Christians who know precisely what is wrong will not love sufficiently to tackle the problem. Dear Mr. C.F. Hogg said once that he felt he should talk to a man about his family, and so he did. The man was angry with him, he said, but later he thanked him because he admonished him lovingly and wisely. Well, now I want to look at a few verses in Paul's letters. First of all, Galatians 6 and 1. Galatians 6 and 1. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a person in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. If a man is overtaken in any trespass. Now some say the meaning is, even if he's detected, he caught like the woman in John chapter 8, and his guilt is beyond doubt, even if he's detected like that, still he must be restored. Others say, no, that's not the meaning, and F.F. Bruce translates it this way, if any of your number is caught off his guard by some sin. Personally, I'm inclined to the second view, that that's what he has in mind. If a person is overtaken, he's surprised, he's taken off his guard by some trespass. But it won't make very much difference to our application of the verse, whichever view we take. Now, the King James Version says, overtaken in a fault. And I think from that many have inferred that the verse is just speaking about something very minor, just some little fault. But you'll find that most versions give either sin or trespass. In any trespass, this version says. And Hogg and Vine say that the net is purposely cast very widely. If a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual. Well, who are these spiritual people? It doesn't refer specifically to the elders, although the elders should all qualify, but it says the spiritual. Now, who are they? Well, the previous paragraph speaks of the fruit of the Spirit. And the chief ingredient, of course, in the fruit of the Spirit is love. And then in 1 Corinthians 3 and Hebrews chapter 5, the spiritual are contrasted not only with the carnal, but also with babes and those unskilled in the word. And so I would say that the spiritual are the loving, mature people who are skilled in the word. That's the spiritual, loving, mature, and skilled in the word. I wonder how many of us would qualify as those who are spiritual. You who are spiritual, restore such a one. It's often been pointed out that the word used for restore here was used of mending a net. It was also used for setting a bone that was out of place or broken. And it would require skill and gentleness to do that, wouldn't it? If you had a broken limb, you wouldn't like a person who was a rough or clumsy or unskilled to try to do it. It could do a lot more damage. And so people are handling those that have gone astray can do more damage than good if they're not truly spiritual, if they're not gentle and not skillful. Restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Francis de Sales was a very saintly man of the 16th and 17th centuries, and he said that a gentleness was the very essence of a Christian spirit. And he confided to a friend that he had spent 3 years trying to cultivate that virtue. You who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Mr. Vine also has pointed out that the tense is the continuous present, suggesting the necessity for patience and perseverance in the process. It may not be a thing that you're able to do in 5 minutes. It may take time. You be restoring him in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself. Now, the King James Version, instead of gentleness, gives meekness. And I don't think the word gentleness really covers the whole thought There are the two sorts, first of all of gentleness and secondly of humility. Gentleness and humility. You've heard of John Bradford, he lived in the 16th century, he saw a man being taken to execution. And he said, "There but for the grace of God go I." And so Paul says, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. And so the verse emphasizes the necessity of love, of gentleness and humility. And that's the secret of restoration. Now we'll turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 6 to 15. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 6 to 15. I won't read all the verses just for the sake of time, but I'll just pick out some. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 6 to 15. Now verse 6 says, "But we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who leads a disorderly life, and not according to the tradition which he received from us." That you withdraw from. Same word is translated in 2 Corinthians 8 and 20 as avoid. You avoid. The NIV says you keep away from. Keep away from a disorderly brother. What's meant by disorderly? Mr. Vine interprets it as meaning with slackness, like soldiers not keeping rank. From verse 11 it appears that Paul is here speaking of people who are idle busybodies. They were idle busybodies. That's how these particular people were disorderly. And he says, not according to the tradition which he received from us. He's not speaking simply of some human tradition. He's speaking of the apostolic tradition. Now, they had been spoken to about this very matter when Paul was with them, as he says in verse 10. They had been spoken to about the matter in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. And now they are being spoken to about the matter again. In other words, they had been spoken to at least three times by the apostle. And so he says, if they don't obey, verse 14, if they don't obey our word in this epistle, and note that person, put a tag on him, one has said, don't keep company with him, refuse to associate with him, send him to Coventry, as we might say. But verse 15 says, yet do not count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. Now the language is different from what you have in Matthew 18, where a person's treated as a heathen man and a publican. It's different from the language of 1 Corinthians 5, where he's treated as a wicked person. It says, do not count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. And so I believe that in this passage, excommunication is not in view, but personal dissociation. I noted the other day that Gary Inrig, in his book Life in His Body, refers this to the Lord's Supper, excluding from the Lord's Supper, but that is certainly not the view, I think, of the best expositors. Mr. Host said, the Lord's table is the last thing to go. I believe that's right. I believe it's a personal discipline, a personal expression of disapproval of these people, that they may be ashamed. All right, now 1 Timothy 1, verses 19 and 20. 1 Timothy 1, verses 19 and 20. Yes, 1 Timothy 1, verses 19 and 20. We should read verse 18 for the connection, but we won't worry about that. Verse 19, having faith and a good conscience, which some having rejected concerning the faith have suffered shipwreck, of whom Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I delivered to Satan, that they may learn not to blaspheme. We refer to that verse again, and as I mentioned, in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, we learn that Hymenaeus said that the resurrection was past already, and he overthrew the faith of some. And so we see that Paul disciplined people for doctrinal evil as well as moral evil. Now sometimes you find people, and they're very particular about moral evil, but very careless about doctrinal evil. You have that in the book of Judges, in Judges chapter 19. You find that the people act as one man with regard to moral evil, but in Judges 18, they do nothing about Micah's idolatry. But Paul was concerned about both of them, the moral evil and the doctrinal evil. Well now, 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 20. 1 Timothy 5 and 20. Those who are sinning, rebuke in the presence of all, that the rest also may fear. Now, first of all, there's a question that's been raised sometimes about this verse. Does it refer only to elders, or is it to be understood generally? I notice that Donald Guthrie in the Tyndale Commentary says it refers simply to elders. But most expositors that I've consulted take the opposite view, that it doesn't only refer to elders, it is intended to be general. Now, the arguments for referring the verse only to elders are, first of all, the previous verse speaks about elders. Verse 19, do not receive an accusation against an elder, except from two or three witnesses. And then verse 22 says, do not lay hands on anyone hastily, and that's thought to refer to elders. But on the other hand, first of all, there is no link in the original between verses 19 and 20. And in the Greek language, if there's any connection between verses, there is sure to be some link there, and there's no link. I think Mr. William Kelly said in one manuscript, one out of thousands is a link, and obviously somebody just put that in order to link the two together, but there's no link between the two of them. And then you notice a change from the singular to the plural. Verse 19 speaks of an elder. Verse 20 says, those who are sinning. And another thing, do you think there's any real reason why this discipline should be applied to elders and not to apply to others? And again, it's not certain that verse 22, do not lay hands on anyone, suddenly refers to elders. Hands were laid on other people besides elders. The seven almoners, or deacons as some people call them, of Acts 6 had hands laid on them. They weren't elders. Paul and Barnabas had hands laid on them in Acts 13. That wasn't to make them elders or appoint them as elders. And Timothy too had hands laid on him, as you read in 1 Timothy 4:14. That wasn't to make him an elder. As a matter of fact, we're not actually told in the New Testament that hands were laid on elders to appoint them, although probably they were, but it is never actually stated. And so I believe that the verse is to be understood generally, and not only in reference to elders. And just I'd like to make just a couple of remarks about it. Those who are sinning rebuke in the presence of all that the rest also may fear. Now, first of all, I believe this is the only place in the New Testament where a public rebuke is called for. And also the only place where Christians are bidden to exercise discipline as a deterrent to others. You don't read that in other places, 1 Corinthians 5, to deter others. Matthew 18, you don't read to deter others. And therefore I believe that these things should not be major factors in discipline. Public rebuke and the idea of a deterrent, they should not be major factors in discipline, but rather reserved for special situations. I believe that the major deterrent to a sin in a church should be the ministry of the word. That should be the major deterrent. Not if you do this, you know, we'll do this to you. The ministry of the word should be the major deterrent. And another point, in this verse, not a single act, I believe, is in view, because it says in this version, those who are sinning. The New American Standard says, those who continue in sin. Weymouth says, those who persist in sin. It's not a single act of sin that is in view, but a course of sin. And again, I think that the verse can hardly refer to a serious offense, such as you read in 1 Corinthians 5, those persist. Persisting in a serious offense required more than a rebuke. Unless it's argued that this is simply a preliminary to some more serious discipline, but that is not suggested. Now, I suggest that the verse refers to cases like those in 2 Thessalonians 3, for example, those idle busybodies, or those in Titus 1 whose mouths must be stopped, or those in 1 Corinthians 6 going to law with one another. If they kept persisting in those things and wouldn't desist, then they might have to face this public rebuke. And remember, too, that Peter was publicly rebuked by Paul in Galatians 2. We can imagine two or three people making nuisances of themselves, like those in 2 Thessalonians 3. They're going about idle, busybodies, and they've been spoken to, and they don't take any notice, and so on. And so it might be considered by the elders that the time has come for a public rebuke. Now, I admit that it would be more difficult to do this today because of the divided state of the church. I'm afraid if you were to do this, the person would pack up and go to the Baptist or something like that. And so great wisdom, I do think, great wisdom is required in putting some of these things into practice. All right, now, Titus chapter 3, verses 9, 10, and 11. Titus chapter 3, verses 9, 10, and 11. But avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless. Reject a divisive man after the first and second admonition, and knowing that such a person is warped and sinning, being self-condemned. Now the King James Version says a heretic, reject a heretic. But the word doesn't mean heretic as we commonly understand the word. When we talk about a heretic, we mean, generally speaking, a man who's unsound on some fundamental point of doctrine. But that's not the meaning of the word. This version gives a divisive man. The NIV similarly says a divisive person. The Good News Bible gives the person who causes divisions. The word comes from a word meaning to choose. And Vine explained it as one who strikes out a line of his own choosing and causes strife, faction, and division. Now, it's not suggested, I think, in the passage that the man is teaching fundamental error, but perhaps he has some of the errors described in verse 9, and he's occupied with genealogies and striving about words and so on, and in that way he becomes a divisive person. Now, we're told to reject such a person. The NIV says, have nothing to do with him, have nothing to do with him. And notice that it's after the first and second admonition. The man is given every opportunity to mend his ways, just as the man in Matthew chapter 18. But what is meant by rejecting, by having nothing to do with him? Again, to quote Mr. Vine, he says, and I think rightly, this does not necessarily imply excommunication. It would probably involve such action as to prevent their activities and certainly their efforts to obtain prominence and exercise their influence. Now, I think that most interpreters would agree with that. You notice Mr. Vine said, not necessarily, but of course in extreme cases it could lead to excommunication. And then Paul says, knowing that such a person is warped and sinning, being self-condemned. He's warped. His mind has a twist. He's unbalanced. He's sinning because he's so obstinate and he refuses to take counsel. He's self-condemned, his own actions condemn him. Well, could such a person be a real Christian? Well, perhaps not in an extreme case, but I think a true believer could go quite a good distance along that road. All right, now a similar passage is Romans 16, verses 17 and 18. Romans 16, verses 17 and 18. Now I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. For those who are such do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by smooth words and flattering speech deceive the hearts of the simple. Now this passage is similar to Titus chapter 3 and verse 10, and Paul says, note them. The NIV says, watch out for them. The King James says, avoid them. The word for reject, it's a different from the word reject in Titus 3 and 10, but I think the meaning is much the same. Don't have anything to do with them. And again, Mr. Vine explains, the apostle is not speaking of excommunication, but a personal dissociation from the offender. Are these people Christians? Well, verse 18 is stronger than Titus 3 and 10. Verse 18, they serving their own belly and so on. And I think if the words are pressed, they could hardly be true Christians. Hanley Mole described them as perverted and perverting teachers, Christian in name. Ironside said that they were ungodly men who had crept in from outside. Well, of course, if that's the case, they would have to be treated as such. But I think that verse 17 could be true of genuine believers, people who cause divisions and offenses. It could be true of genuine believers, and so it would be necessary to discriminate between different people. Now, back to Titus again. Titus 1, verses 9 to 13. Titus 1, verses 9 to 13. Again, we should start earlier, but still it's not very good to start at a comma, but just for the time. And verse 9, it's speaking about elders, what elders should be able to do. Holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. For there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not, for the sake of dishonest gain. One of them, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. Therefore rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith. Again, are such people, persons, Christians? Well, again, I would say if we press the words, they could hardly be. But certainly believers could have some of these characteristics. And again, nothing is actually said in the passage about excommunication. It says that these teachers' mouths should be stopped or bridled. But how is that to be done? How were their mouths to be stopped or bridled? Guthrie in the Tyndale Commentary says, presumably by the skillful presentation of the true doctrine mentioned in verse 9. You see, that's what the elders had to do, to exhort and convict those who contradict, and so their mouths would be stopped or bridled. And the Ellicott Commentary compares Matthew 22, verses 34 to 46, where it says, our Lord, by his wise, powerful yet gentle words, first put the Sadducees to silence, and then so answered the Pharisees, that neither durst any man from that day ask him any more questions. Their mouths were stopped. I think, however, myself, that the word bridle, that strong word bridle, does suggest that sterner measures might sometimes be necessary. The pure exposition of the word mightn't always be sufficient to stop or bridle their tongues. And remember what it says 1 Timothy 5 and 20, those who sin rebuke before all, and sometimes something like that might be necessary in order to bridle them. Well, then you have verse 13. It says, rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith. Well, now, does this refer to the false teachers? The false teachers, of verses 10 and 11, or does it refer to the Cretans? Well, I think it refers chiefly to the Cretans, because you see from verse 10, these false teachers are mainly Jewish. It says, especially those of the circumcision, and then he goes on to speak of the Cretans. And so I think he's speaking, thinking in verse 13, mainly of the influence of these people upon the Cretans. And so the Cretans needed to be rebuked sharply. Well, you might say that seems very different from what Paul advocated in Galatians 6 and 1. If a person is overtaken by a trespass, your spirit will restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, in the spirit of meekness. And here he says, rebuke sharply. Well, I think it's just as with children. Sometimes the gentleness is quite sufficient, but sometimes you need a little more than gentleness. Sometimes you need some sharpness and severity. And these Cretans apparently were behaving just as foolish children, and they needed something of this sharpness. Again, I don't think it refers so much to the teachers, because I don't think even a sharp rebuke would make those teachers sound in the faith. It might close their mouths, but not sufficient to make them sound in the faith. But hopefully it was sufficient to draw the Cretans away from them. Now, before leaving Paul's letters, let me remind you that at the end of the second talk, I spoke of the importance of self-discipline. Now, in Paul's letters, you have not only assembly discipline, but also you have self-discipline. I mentioned that 1 Corinthians 14 is really a chapter of discipline, regulating the meeting, but it's self-discipline. They are to discipline themselves. It's not a discipline imposed by others. They are to accept certain rules and discipline themselves. Again, in chapter 6, they're going to law with one another, and Paul encourages them to discipline themselves in that regard. He doesn't say anything about that he was going to discipline them for it. Again, in chapter 11, you read of their unrestrained eating and drinking in connection with the Lord's Supper. He says, let a man examine himself. If we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. He encourages them to discipline themselves. And so if Christians can be taught self-discipline, there'll be less need for assembly discipline. Now, all the passages so far I think we've been looking at have been from the letters of Paul, and just for a minute or two I'd like to glance at one or two in John's writings. Now, 2 John chapter, I said chapter, that was a very foolish one, 2 John verses 10 and 11. 2 John verses 10 and 11. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your house, nor greet him. For he who greets him shares in his evil deeds. Well, now, what doctrine is this that John is referring to? Well, if we read the first part of verse 7, we'll see. Many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. In other words, these people deny the true humanity of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, that was a Gnostic teaching, a Gnostic error, and it was very serious, because if Christ was not truly human, he couldn't die. It undermined the very doctrine of the atonement. And some believe that is why John in his Gospel records the fact that when our Lord's body was pierced, how it was pierced with a spear, out came blood and water. That emphasized the fact that he was really dead. He was really dead. He really died. But if he wasn't truly human, he could not have died. And so that was what these people were denying. And so John says, if he doesn't bring this doctrine. Now, I'm sure that John is thinking of an official teacher. He's not thinking of an unbeliever. An unbeliever wouldn't bring it along, but that's not the same. Or even thinking of someone who's not properly taught in this matter, but an official teacher who denies these things. Well, what about a Jehovah's Witness? If you want to discuss anything with Jehovah's Witnesses, must you keep them standing on the door, or is it permissible to allow them to sit down in the sitting room? Well, I don't personally see much difference between discussing it at the door and discussing it in the sitting room, provided you're careful. I suggest that what John has primarily in mind is helping them on their way by hospitality. Helping them on their way by hospitality. I just mentioned that some very able teachers like Professor Bruce and John Stott think that the elect lady is really the church. It's a kind of allegorical way of referring to the church, and so to receive into the house means to receive into the church. Well, I'm not sure that that is correct, and not all scholars accept that. For example, Wes Scott and William Kelly, who are very great scholars in their expositions of John, reject that view. And personally, I'm inclined to think that the elect lady was, in fact, a lady. Well, now, just I'll make a reference to Revelation. In Revelation 2 and 2, you find that Ephesus is commended because it has tried those who say they are apostles and are not. Then in chapter 2 and verse 14, Pergamos is censured for having those who hold the doctrine of Balaam. And so you see there was discipline for doctrine, for evil doctrine as well as for moral evil. But just as it is with moral evil, so with doctrinal evil. It's only in extreme form, such as the denial of basic truth concerning the person and work of Christ, that would call for excommunication. On minor matters, we must learn to be patient with one another and not to forget Romans chapter 14.